Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of AI podcast. So I do podcasting full-time. My main podcast is the Voices of VR podcast, where I've been covering the field of virtual reality for the past 3 years. I've done over 750 interviews, and I found that the topic of artificial intelligence started to come up over and over again, and it seemed to be a topic that kind of deserved its own podcast. I tried to figure out what was happening in artificial intelligence, and there's a huge gap between what's happening at the cutting edge with the people who are really driving this field forward and what the media is covering about it. So my approach with the Voices of VR has always been to just go to the conferences where the leading experts of a topic will be and to just ask them and have them explain this technology to me, which is exactly what I've been doing with the Voices of AI. At this point, I've recorded about 90 different interviews at 3 different conferences. One was the International Joint Conference of Artificial Intelligence. Then I went to O'Reilly AI, as well as the Artificial Intelligence and Interactive Digital Entertainment. That was more about creative AI and storytelling. I see that we're moving from the information age into the experiential age, where our future is going to be a lot more immersive and interactive. Now, when it comes to immersion, I've been exploring human experience and frameworks for looking at experiential design for virtual reality, and it's the interactive components that I think that artificial intelligence has started to come in. How do you create an interactive narrative? What is conversational interfaces going to look like? What is intelligence? How do we create intelligence within our experiences? And so I just see that there's this technological roadmap that is going to be moving into more and more immersion and more interactivity. And so on the Voices of AI podcast, I'm going to be asking a whole range of these fundamental questions of what is the nature of intelligence? Can computers think? How do you combine the ability to perceive and understand the world into models that are going to make decisions and take action into the world? What is the role of manipulative intelligence or perceptual intelligence or social and emotional intelligence, as well as cognitive intelligence? And what are the new Turing tests of this next generation that create benchmarks that we can work towards? So there's a whole range of fascinating questions that I think we'll be diving into within the Voices of AI and looking at models and frameworks for experiential design, as well as looking at the full wide potential of all the different ways that AI is going to be applied, whether it's in entertainment or education or medicine or communications or technology and society. There's pretty much no domain of human experience that I think that AI is not going to be touching in the future. And there's a whole range of ethical and moral and philosophical implications when we talk about intelligent agents, like what is superintelligence? What are the standards for explainable AI so that we can be sure that we're not going to be replicating any sort of unconscious biases that we may have? And how do we create AI that is interacting and collaborating with humans? And so we have this human-aware AI. And at the end of the day, I think that AI is just a mirror for what it means to be human. And the more that we study about AI, the more that we learn about the nature of intelligence, as well as the limits and thresholds of consciousness, as whether or not we're going to be able to actually create conscious computers, or if that's something that is completely unique to humans and unable to be replicated within a simulation. So these are some of the deeper questions that I'm going to be asking to some of the leading researchers within the field of artificial intelligence. So this very first interview that I have is with Rao Kambapardai. He's both the president of the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence, as well as the committee chair for the International Joint Conference of Artificial Intelligence that happened in 2016. And Rao comes from constraints and planning, but he also takes a very holistic approach and gives a nice historical background and context to the field of artificial intelligence and what is trying to actually be achieved at this Ichikai conference. So we're going to be covering all of that and more on the first episode of the Voices of AI podcast. So this interview with Rao happened on Thursday, July 14th, 2016, at the International Joint Conference on Artificial Intelligence in New York City. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
I am Rao Kambapardai, and I'm at Arizona State University, a faculty member there. I've been working in AI like forever. My main research interests are planning and decision making. And my most recent interests in that direction are planning and decision making in the context of human machine or human robot teams. And what are the new challenges that come up when robots or machines, when they're working with humans in the loop. And in addition to that, you know, I'm actually for 2016, I'm the program chair for Ichikai, International Joint Conference on Artificial Intelligence. And I'm also just became the president of AAAI, which is Association for Advancement of Artificial Intelligence. Yeah, that's my sort of the background.
So it seems like Ichikai is kind of a combination of all the different subdomains of artificial intelligence coming here together to cross-pollinate and fuse knowledge about what's happening in AI. So how do you kind of understand the major different subdomains of the AI landscape?
Yes, so that's a very good point, actually. So, and in fact, you know, Ichikai is the oldest AI conference. It started in 1969, and the general original goal of AI was basically to come up with software artifacts that would show intelligent behavior that would involve lots of capabilities, ability to learn, ability to perceive the world, ability to manipulate in the world, ability to make decisions about the future. So all of these were considered just direct part of AI. And over time, of course, individual sub-disciplines also started having their own strong separate sub-communities. So obviously machine learning has, you know, several conferences, ICML, NIPS, and perception, of course, vision conferences are there. And similarly, pretty much every area has its own special conferences. So what makes Ichikai still very special and very relevant in this day and age is essentially that you need to bring all these things back together in terms of everybody understands that intelligent agency is really a combination of all these capabilities and the interplay between them. And so that's while people might be going to, let's say, CVPR to just look at what is the latest advance in vision. At Ichikai, you would basically see papers which are using perception, vision, and combining it with robotic decision making. And so the integration across these subdomains is something that Ichikai is like uniquely qualified to do. And so, in fact, one of the things that we deliberately and very consciously did was it would have been a simple thing to make the conference be just a federated conference. So there would be like a machine learning track, there'll be a planning track, there'll be a vision track, there'll be a robotics track. And we actually fought hard against that direction, because if you do that, people still sort of stay in their silos. And the whole point of coming to Ichikai is there should be the work that is actually cutting across these subdomains is the most interesting work. All the action is at the interfaces of these subdomains. And so we wanted to have a way of both doing the reviewing as a paper submission process where people that encourages particularly the sort of the integrated work which crosses these subdomain boundaries. And that's why here there's one main track, that's it. And while, of course, the sessions will have names which are sort of related to the papers that are probably the majority papers in that area, it's still the case that there are many papers which crossed across different subfields of AI. And I think Ichikai is like the great forum for most of those papers. In addition, of course, to the fact that we do get the best machine learning papers, the best planning, knowledge representation, AMAs, agent sorts of papers still submitted to the conference.
Yeah, my perception just from the outside coming in was that there is a huge swell of interest and excitement around a lot of these deep reinforcement learning, machine learning techniques using neural networks and throwing lots of GPUs and big data and be able to drive these really amazing empirical results. AlphaGo is probably the most prominent of that recently. And yet there's all these other sort of more top-down approaches that have been around for a while. It sounds like even DeepMind was doing a little bit of a fusion of the bottom-up and the top-down. I think of it as sort of more objective left brain rational planning that we have in our minds. But there's also the more subjective qualitative experiences that it feels like neural networks are being fed an experience of data, and that sort of helps generate their qualitative or subjective, may not be rational or explainable, but something that is driving like clear results in terms of vision and some of these other tasks like in AlphaGo. But it seems like there's a little bit of a tension between those two, and that some of this tension perhaps goes back to the very origins and beginning of AI, but also perhaps a drive towards fusing it and taking the advantages of both the top-down planning and the bottom-up. So from your perspective, I'm just curious.
I think it's, first of all, it's a fascinating line of things to talk about, honestly. I guess one thing, I'll put a slightly different way of looking at these things. So if you look at the successes of AI over the years, back in the 80s, there was this whole expert systems revolution, which was essentially what you're calling, I guess, the left brain, the analytical writing rules and doing chaining through that. And then 90s, when Deep Blue won over Kasparov, that was mostly essentially systematized, much better systematic understanding of how to do this reasoning, you know. And then it was in the most recent years, in 2000, especially early 2000, it's been perception. Perception and manipulation. Manipulation is still catching up, but the perception, there have been great breakthroughs. That's the speech recognition, the image recognition, that sort of pushed AI into the cell phones being held by everybody. And so that's something that's obviously a great driver of the public interest in AI, because everybody knows that they're using that technology. Now, if you look at this, one of the interesting questions has been, there are two different things to think about. One is, if you think of how humans, when, you know, human babies get their capabilities, little babies do much better perception than, for the longest time, and even now, the much better perception of the world than the best robots. And they do amazingly better manipulation of the world than the robots. Okay, what they were not able to do is this reasoning task. That's why we put them to school, and 20 years of schooling, large amounts of tuition, and then that's when you get to this SATs, etc., which is all about this logical reasoning. Now, obviously, being human involves combining all these, and that's what we're able to see the world as well as reason about it. And the two contrasts to me are, one, it's kind of interesting that AI made progress on being able to take SATs before it was able to make progress on seeing the SAT questions, understanding what is written there. That's just an interesting, fascinating contrast to me. And the second thing is, it's very interesting. I mean, when you think about AlphaGo, as David Silver is pointing out on the first day's keynote talk, the reason it actually went where it went was, in fact, the earlier stage of AlphaGo was mostly based on the reasoning techniques. David Silver's own paper, for which they got the Prominent Paper Award here, it was essentially pushing it with Monte Carlo tree search. And that sort of connected to the way Deep Blue won against Kasparov. It was just very fast min-max search with alpha beta pruning thrown in. And what AlphaGo added to the mix is, it's this perception component. I mean, perception is not just looking at a scene and saying, oh, there's a cup in it. We always, when we say that we understood a situation, we say, I see it. And that see is basically what he's doing in terms of learning these features about the board configuration. But then the interesting thing, he's not just able to get the best performance with just either one of those two components. He had to combine both of them. And this is where this perception and reasoning combined together is where all the action is going to be. And so in some sense, I don't actually see any either or. I mean, while, of course, if you are having mostly your cell phones recognizing your speech, all they need to do is just recognize the speech. And so that's very much of just a perception task. But if any agent, such as a cell phone or anything, it needs to also make decisions about the future. It needs to combine this perception with reasoning. And those things haven't yet come into the market. So I think that in the next few years, understanding how to combine this progress in perception and already existing progress in reasoning is going to be what is going to be very interesting. Within AI, most of us basically think of the current great interest in deep learning, essentially, as the third coming of neural networks. I mean, there was a first coming with perceptrons. There was a second coming in the 80s when backprop was invented. And the third coming really is, the theory remained more or less the same. Convolution networks were there way long back. What happened was, now essentially we have enough of a computational software that they're actually being used. And plus with the fact that we have all these cell phones and so on, it's being used much more in a day-to-day scenario. And that, of course, it's great that brings AI to the public mind. They're basically thinking about this. But while the technical progress goes in overall, still went in more or less a monotonic progress with a higher gradient in the more recent years, but I think the public's own perception of when AI went from disappointment to, oh my God, it's going to take over, has been much swifter. You know, it's like almost a vertical takeoff. That's actually also brings us to the very exciting times in general now of this whole public perception of AI. And, you know, one thing that worries me a little bit is, what Hollywood has been saying has become somewhat of the Terminator viewpoint, has also unfortunately become some of the mainstream media's direction in pushing AI. And that doesn't actually make much sense because there was no sudden abilities of the sort of quote-unquote harmful AI that was just going to take off. Any sufficiently impactful technology should care about its social issues and fairness issues and ethical issues. It's great, and in fact, I believe that AI, that's one of the big things right now. There is a lot of interest in, you know, ethics in autonomous cars, you know, the whole trolley problem, for example, in the context of autonomous cars, the whole idea of biased data sets. There was a fascinating discussion in one of the panels at this conference on if you're learning from the data set, you know, a learner doesn't have values built in. And if you are learning from a data set, if most of the health data sets in this country are basically from white male diagnostics, and if you are not aware of it, you will come up with patterns that actually work very well for that population, but not for the entire representative population. And so these are interesting issues that AI should care about. But the things that I find somewhat off-putting are these more sensationalistic views of how do we stop the super intelligence from taking over. And in fact, I think an unnecessary sort of obsession with those sorts of issues might make us miss the more important immediate ethical issues in fielding the AI systems, which are much less sexier. They don't have the Terminator robot standing with a gun, but they're just as important. And so for this conference, one of the things we actually did was we wanted to have this discussion also go on. And of course, the conference is for the technical results, but it's also a place where the community gets together. And we wanted to have these discussions be taken place. So the two things that we did here, one was to make the special theme for each guy to be human-aware AI, and to point out, of course, that there's a lot of research with very highly interesting intellectual challenges that bring basically how do AI systems have to behave when they are working in concert with AI. And, you know, my tagline is, we get to invent the future, why deliberately invent a dystopian future and be all paranoid about it? You know, we are actually working on, there's these research problems about getting the systems to work with humans. And so there's like a technical track, there are two invited talks, and there's several early career research talks on this particular topic. And part of my interest in doing this is to shift the discussion from superintelligence control problem and saying that we really get to invent this future, and, you know, and there's this great work being done. The other thing is, I also wanted to have a representation of the broader public discussion about AI impacts, but we did not want to have it be dominated again by this one-sided thing. And so I'm actually very happy that, you know, White House Office of Science and Technology Policy had run these four very balanced workshops, partly because IIII was involved in setting the stage for them. And, you know, these workshops won AI and the law, and AI and social good, AI and safety, of course, and then finally AI and ethics. So the representatives from these four workshops are coming this afternoon and in the OSTP, White House OSTP workshop debrief panel. And I thought they would actually talk about what happened in their workshop, and the community can also get a sense of what was discussed and, you know, give more input. So this was one other thing that we are pretty happy about, that getting to do in this conference.
Yeah, and one of the things that you were talking about the reasoning and combining that with perception aspects of AI, is that with this reasoning, it seems like here at the conference, does that include like planning and knowledge representation and constraints? And maybe you could talk about the specific subdomains that are represented here that really kind of address that.
Reasoning, yes. So basically, I think the reasoning aspect of the spectrum is essentially the sub-areas of search, constraint satisfaction, and planning are front and center. Reinforcement learning is, again, they're all connected areas. If I may take one step back, in general, there is a distinction between capabilities and approaches, okay? Reasoning is a capability an intelligent agent needs. It can't just learn and not use the knowledge it has learned. Using the knowledge is about basically doing the sequential reasoning about how, if I do this, what will happen in the future. And then at that point, I get to do this other action. After that, what happens? And being able to do this mental projection of how the world will evolve while you're doing your actions. It's the capability that's very important. Of course, which particular approach should you take researchers have been trying very different sets of approaches. So all these things, constraint processing, planning, and reinforcement learning, all come under that particular set. Whereas if you look at the sessions on just a supervised learning, unsupervised learning, they're mostly interested in learning patterns in the data. And the most interesting thing would be how what you learned would be used to make your decisions. Historically, in AI, people have either focused on, I'll assume that I have a model in certain representation and focus on inference or reasoning. Okay, and then some others who said, we will just learn the model and leave somebody else the actual duty of figuring out how to do inference. Increasingly, what is happening is this realization that from a learning side, if you're not using your model, and if every time it's one shot, learning a pattern from 30 billion examples, that's not going to be useful. You have to be doing lifelong learning. And what that means is the learned knowledge has to be used for reasoning. Okay, and from the reasoning community, planning, constraint satisfaction, etc. side, there is increasing realization that if you develop very sophisticated inference methods for particular classes of representation, and you don't know how to learn those as effectively, then you are sort of wasting. That's a kind of direction that won't be as fruitful. And so it makes a lot more sense to think in terms of what sorts of models can you learn and use for reasoning. And this sometimes might make the models be much shallower than the ones that people are used to when they handwrite them. But that's the cost you play, because that is a way you can make sure that you're taking both ends together. So in my own group, I've been, as I said, in a planning researcher. And, you know, obviously in the very beginnings of my career, I was mostly focusing on assuming a certain kinds of representations for the model, how to do reasoning effectively. Most of my current work is very different. It looks at the spectrum of models that can be learned, and for each point in that spectrum, what's the best way we can exploit them through reasoning. And so that's sort of the direction I see going on in the community right now.
And I was a little bit surprised in the process of talking to over 40 people now here at the conference, and that there seems to be a lack of specificity as to what exactly artificial intelligence is. And, you know, there's the Turing test, which is one way of coming up with a benchmark of, can you have this conversation with a computer and be convinced that it's a human? But there seems to be a multitude of different types of benchmarks and different types of tests that are out there. Instead of just one test, it seems like in order to really address intelligence, there has to be many different tests of different components. And at the press conference, you or someone else said, you know, some of the three biggest open questions are, how did the universe begin? Who are we and why are we here? As well as, what is the nature of intelligence? So for you, how do you define artificial intelligence, or how do you think about the future of these different Turing test benchmarks?
So I think that's a good question. Actually, I was the guy at the press conference. I was saying that. So the thing that's interesting to me is there is this whole issue of definition of intelligence, and then making artificial intelligence is making computers exhibit what everybody would consider as intelligence. Now, even if you come to the human intelligence aspect, of course, that's a fraught subject because we have had centuries of debate on that. But at the minimum, I think it's very non-controversial to say that we have perceptual intelligence and we have manipulative intelligence, the ability to manipulate the world. We have cognitive reasoning style intelligence, and then we have social intelligence and we have emotional intelligence. Now, at least at the level of just talking about it, these are all there, but most of the early interest in AI, for example, you know, that sort of Turing test was trying to capture. So the Turing test, as it was originally set up, didn't require you to have much of a perceptual intelligence. It wouldn't have checked if you had emotional intelligence. It wouldn't have checked if you had social intelligence. And it was very good at basically doing this sort of cognitive aspects of the intelligence, right? One of the things that is changing, and in fact, when I teach this in class for my students, any intro to AI class, in the beginning, we have to sort of talk about what is it that we're trying to automate here. When we get to social intelligence and emotional intelligence, you know, my byline is that, you know, for the men in the audience, emotional intelligence is the one that you do apparently lack. And for the engineers in the audience, the social intelligence is the one that you apparently lack. But the point of it is, there hasn't been that much that we took that seriously about automating. I mean, basically, the social and emotional intelligence aspects have not been within the purview of AI for quite a while. because we were sort of thinking of how to make an autonomous agent go off and do things by itself. Another of my things is that AI has been extremely good very far away from humanity than very close to humanity. We had Spirit and Rover loitering around Mars, and that is no problem for us. And in autonomous cars going in Nevada desert is not a problem. What's more interesting, of course, that we are getting to slowly is machines and humans together. And when you have that, you have to bring in aspects of social intelligence, you have to bring in aspects of emotional intelligence. So going back to this question of Turing test and its utility, first of all, I mean, Alan Turing, obviously, this was humongous credit that at the very dawn of computing, he didn't ask himself, what's the biggest spreadsheet that computers can handle? He was asking himself, can machines think? And this obviously had a tremendous impact on the way computers have been used and the AI as a field actually existed. But it's also true that people understand the limitations of Turing test the way it was originally proposed. And there are all sorts of interesting versions of the Turing test that are coming up. Just like we still haven't figured out what is the right IQ test for humans, right? And then there's all these quotes that the first IQ test made by Kalahari Bushmen, the entire Western civilization will flunk. And, you know, this sort of a thing exists on our own side. And it's not too surprising to some extent that AI hasn't completely figured out one single monolithic definition. What is a sign of progress, in my view, is realizing that all these other aspects of intelligence are just as important. There's a lot of papers in this conference on computers showing emotional intelligence. And there are lots of papers on this conference on computers having social skills when they're interacting with other humans. It's not clear that robots need social skills just between themselves, but it's very important that they need them when they're interacting with us, because we are not going to change that quickly. And so a kind of a roundabout way of answering your question is, I don't think any of us can write like a formal definition of what AI is, because we can't yet write what a formal definition of intelligence is. However, I think the scope of AI used to be more restricted in the beginnings to this cognitive reasoning style intelligence. Then it expanded to have perceptual intelligence. That's where all your vision breakthroughs have been coming. But now it really also includes the social intelligence and emotional intelligence aspects. And that to me is a progress. And there are actually workshops. I think there was a workshop in last year's IJCAI about which there's an AI magazine article on alternatives to Turing test. It's not so much that you could come up with a battery of tests which will look at different aspects of intelligence. That sort of work certainly is going on. So I think your point is still well taken. We in the community realize there is no single formal definition, but there is no single formal definition of human intelligence. And we are supposedly trying to basically automate it, you know, with the computers. And so it's not surprising. But one last point on this thing is, at the beginnings of AI, I mean, I've been in the community for forever. When I started as a graduate student, it was quite clear that the only thing that you're trying to automate is how does an autonomous robot just go on and live by itself without any interest in making sure that it has to deal with other humans, okay? And so anything like human factors, anything like emotions and social intelligence were seen sort of as, why is this relevant to what's going on in AI research? And that is changing quite significantly now. And in particular, that's one of the reasons we brought up this human-aware AI theme, because humans are emotional beings. Humans expect social skills. And if the robots and machines that we are inventing are to live with us, then they need those skills. And if we are inventing robots and machines that don't need to live with us, I would wonder, why are we inventing such a future? Then that basically we are doing it just to become paranoid. And, you know, why should we invent our own obsolescence? There's no real reason. And so in that sense, what used to be seen as sort of soft and fuzzy aspects of AI have become also equally central, because it's like in the context of human-aware AI, you do need to care about emotional and social intelligence almost as much as you care about perceptual and cognitive reasoning kind of things.
Yeah, the surprising thing to me is that by coming here and learning a lot more about artificial intelligence, it's kind of like a mirror of learning about my own sense of my intelligence and all these different things of emotional intelligence, social intelligence. So do you think that's a motivating factor for a lot of people that are into artificial intelligence, is to learn more about themselves?
I mean, obviously, I think how we get into the field versus what we do, obviously, are two different things. But you could not be any more right on one of the biggest motivating factors as to why many of us get into AI. So just to put this in sort of a perspective, so, you know, some years back in my university, my students nominated me to give a last lecture. And so the last lecture I gave was all about AI and its connections to life, what I learned about life based on my research in AI. And I have this thing that when AI people have kids, they see the kids as a bit of an experiment in progress. And it's just fascinating. This stuff is becoming even more so in the context of human-aware AI. We learn something about ourselves by making agents that are like us. And that's the reason why, when we understand nature of intelligence, as I said earlier, of the three fundamental questions, you know, what's the origin of the universe, what's the origin of life, and what's the nature of intelligence, clearly making computers intelligent is not going to necessarily tell you how the brain works on the surface of it. But on the other hand, as I say, you know, there's this other part that when you do, when you actually program something, you really understand it. So if I am able to actually make artificial agents that have all the signs of intelligence that we are so proud of as humans, you had to have understood how it works. And sometimes when we do this, Marvin Minsky, who just passed away at the beginning of this year, has said this beautiful thing that with understanding comes a sense of loss. Okay, and when we realize exactly how emotional intelligence works, how social intelligence works, maybe there will be a sense of loss, but it's still deep understanding about how our own real claim to fame in the evolution, which is basically our intelligence, you know, what is it, how does it work, you know, what's the origins. And so clearly that is just always, for me at least, it's always a background theme. And as I was saying, the human-aware AI aspects are making it even more so, because I, for example, realize that humans just expect explanations. My kid, even when he was very young, if you ask him to do something, the first question is why? We expect explanations. But it is also the case that it's not that the explanation should be true explanation, there should be an explanation. And we are easily gullible too in that sense. And there's this whole thing called copier room paradox, where if there's a bunch of people standing in front of a copier trying to get their paper copied, somebody else who wants to cut through the line just can come to the line and say, pardon me, I need to copy, and we'll let them in. And this just makes no sense, because you are trying to copy too, but it looks like they're using something like an explanation pattern. And so, yeah, okay, you have an explanation, so I'll let you get through. And this is fascinating to me, because it will bring up a second order of ethical issues in AI, which is just going to be fascinating in its own right. Because when we can figure out how humans trust each other, when we can figure out how humans explain things to each other and automate them into these agents, then the question would be, how do you deal with the possibility that I can manipulate your trust of me? I mean, one of the whole points of this evolutionary hypothesis that we needed the size of the brains we have not to run away from the tigers of the savannah, but to deal with each other. And we do this humongous reasoning about each other's mental models. And that's extremely important. That's a very high sign of intelligence, and that's going to be front and center for human-aware AI systems. But when you do that, it also opens up the possibility of manipulating. So agents can manipulate the humans' beliefs. And, you know, it'd be very interesting ethical questions. I mean, when my kid started lying, I was proud, honestly, because that's a sign of intelligence. I mean, that's the ability to realize that my mental model is different from yours. But I also hope that, as I say in my class, that integrity is not the ability of not knowing how to cheat, but knowing that you have the ability to cheat and deciding not to. And that's a very interesting ethical question. How do we bring that in the design of these systems? I see that as like a second order fascinating ethical issues that could come up later on, way before we have to deal with super intelligence trying to take over the world.
And finally, what do you see as kind of the ultimate potential of artificial intelligence and what it might be able to enable?
I think we have been tool builders as humanity. We've been tool builders. And we have made lots of tools that have amplified our potential in multiple different ways. The one thing that we still, I guess, are somewhat more defensive and proud of is our intelligence. But AI tools that we build will essentially amplify our cognition. So you could have this whole set of these sorts of things like human-aware AI systems could be your amplifiers of your intelligence in multiple different ways. They can sort of give some of the routine cares that we might not be able to have because of the labor issues and about the availability of the people and so on. And honestly, I think the issue of when you are amplifying these capabilities, how do you wind up using them is something that I guess a futurist will probably have to deal with more qualified than I am. But I think from a technical perspective, I see that we are closer to getting many of these aspects of human intelligence understood to the extent that we will have a variety of tools. You know, the cell phone, there's this thing that Google search is a great tool because there's a generation of kids. When I was a kid, if somebody asked me something, I might say, I don't know. And I would probably assume that there's no way of finding the answer. We have a generation of kids who have this certainty, metaphysical certainty, that everything has an answer. You just have to ask Google. And that's, in some sense, it changes your own humanity. How it changes, I can't directly say because I'm still from the older generation. But having these amplifying tools would be having very profound impact on how humans themselves will be actually living. This is why I think it's very important that we develop these systems with complete understanding of the fact that they will be collaborating and cohabiting with humans rather than just develop them completely on a different parallel track and then finally worry, are they going to take over?
I'm sorry, anything else that's left unsaid that you'd like to say?
I mean, these are great, exciting times to be in AI, and people within the community always knew that we are making steady progress. What's changed seriously is the public perception of the potential of AI has just sort of had almost like a phase transition, and that brings up its own interesting set of challenges. I think as community, we not only should we be doing all the great research that we are doing, but it's important to make sure that the public understands what the real story is as against the sensationalized story. As much as I respect all these various people who are sort of basically making these pontifications on AI, many of them do not have any actual understanding of the even introductory level AI. As a scientific community, we should make sure that the public is informed as to what is real versus what is science fiction. And in doing so, I'm also, I think, very excited about the fact that the community is taking, now that you are having an impact on the society, we are taking issues of ethics, of how to use our technology in the best ways possible. In some sense, the interest in that is already a sign of the impact, because nobody cares about a technology that's not working, whether or not it's being ethically used. If it's not working, how does it matter? I think the fact that we are successful also brings us these interesting questions that we need to engage with the society at large. And that's something that we try to do at ICHCAI, the conference, in a small way. And I hope to continue doing that in the next 2 years as the IIII president.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
So that was Rao Kambhampati. He's a professor at Arizona State University. He was the general chairman of the International Joint Conference of Artificial Intelligence in 2016. And he's also the president of the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence. So I have a number of different takeaways about this interview. Is that, first of all, I really appreciate Rao's holistic approach to thinking about the field of artificial intelligence. And the way that he describes the different dimensions of intelligence actually maps over quite nicely to my elemental experiential design framework. So in that, the mental and social presence maps over to the cognitive and social intelligence. The active presence, where you're expressing your agency and being able to interact with an experience, is the manipulative intelligence. And so how are these intelligent agents able to learn about the world by being able to interact and manipulate it? Then there's the embodied or environmental presence, which is the equivalent to the perceptual intelligence. And so what are the sensory inputs and to be able to take data from the world and be able to understand it? And I think that the whole supervised learning and machine learning and computer vision are all in that realm of being able to actually perceive the world. One of the things that Rao said is that artificial intelligence has been able to answer a question from an SAT test before they're able to actually see and read the question. And then finally, there's the emotional intelligence, which maps over to the emotional presence. And that has to do with, in VR and experiential design, a lot about the story and narrative, as well as the music and anything that's engaging the emotions. When it comes to artificial intelligence, that emotional intelligence has much more to do with the human-aware AI. Is the AI able to pick up on your emotions? Are they able to exhibit or mimic emotions so that you're able to relate to it as something that is beyond just a machine? But human-aware AI, I think, was a huge part of both the emotional and social intelligence. And these are the things that used to be within the AI community thought as more fuzzy. But yet, when we think about these deeper ethical and moral questions when it comes to artificial intelligence, then they're trying to figure out ways to model and integrate these both social and emotional intelligence within these intelligent agents so that they can actually integrate into human society. So Rao is coming from the constraints and planning and reasoning side of artificial intelligence. And so he makes a differentiation between capabilities and approaches. Reasoning is a capability, and there's many different approaches, whether that's through search and constraints, stratification and planning and knowledge representation and reinforcement learning. All of these are ways of being able to create mental projections of the future and be able to actually plan and make decisions around that. And then on the perceptual side, we have these new machine learning and computer vision techniques that are using things where they're unsupervised learning or supervised learning, where they're able to just like take a massive amount of data and organically determine the features of a system. But either way, once you have that ability to make subjective judgments, then you have to be able to know what to do with that information in a larger framework of this reasoning. And I think AlphaGo is a perfect metaphor for that. And what Rao was saying is that AlphaGo is using these Monte Carlo tree searches in order to do this top-level constraints and planning reasoning, which is something that was very similar to what had been done with Deep Blue, but the complications of the Go game is just exponentially more difficult than chess. And so AlphaGo was able to seamlessly blend these two approaches. That did have the supervised learning of being able to play against itself, but then kind of blend it with a top-down approach of the Monte Carlo tree research. So Rao was saying that there's currently no great definition for human intelligence of coming up with an IQ test. And is that actual representation of your intelligence? Or if you take an SAT test, and he said that the first time that the Calamari Bushmen are able to create their own IQ test, then everybody in the Western world would fail that. There's a certain bias in terms of Western culture, which is very mental and cognitive. And so how do you start to integrate these other dimensions of intelligence when you think about manipulative intelligence or emotional intelligence or perceptual intelligence or social intelligence, all these other things that as we move forward, we're going to be coming up with more and more defined Turing tests and benchmarks that are trying to be more specific for what that actually means. And that the more we set those benchmarks, the more we can compare what humans are able to do. There's all sorts of things that humans can do that AI can't. For example, just understanding common sense things. That's something that turns out to be a very difficult concept to be able to embed within the construct of artificial intelligence. There is this really interesting quote that Rao had said from Marvin Minsky, which is that with understanding comes a sense of loss. And the way that I understand that is that the more that we think we understand something, the more that the mystery and the curiosity is gone. We've lost all sort of wonder and awe about, you know, how a system works. And once you are able to come up with a symbolic model of that, it's able to essentially replicate that reality, then there's a loss there of that mystery and appreciation. And so as we start to understand the nature of intelligence, I think there's a certain amount of awe and wonder about whether or not human beings have consciousness or something that is intelligent that is going to be transcendent to what we're going to be able to model and understand and be able to put into machines. So are machines going to be able to think? Are they going to be able to be conscious? What's it mean to have these super intelligent beings? Are they going to be able to have the ethical and moral development? And are we going to be able to model that? And so there's a lot of deep, interesting questions that I think are driving a lot of interest within artificial intelligence. I see that within the culture, AI has gone through these different technological evolutions such that we have initial innovations of AI back in the 50s, and then we've had these kind of bespoke applications and approaches of trying to systematize AI, like the expert systems in the 80s. Now that we're actually creating systems that are integrated in a way and they're being released into the public in a mass consumer way with all the major technology companies, whether it's Microsoft or Google or Apple or Facebook or IBM or Amazon, all of these companies are like the leaders of artificial intelligence research and creating algorithms within their systems that are driving a lot of our culture. And so day to day, we're doing Google searches, or we're searching on Amazon and getting recommended products, or we're on Netflix and seeing what movies we should be watching next, or we're on Facebook where there's AI that's deciding what we are interested in, or we have conversational interfaces with Amazon Echo and Siri and Google Assistant and Microsoft Cognitive Services and IBM Watson, who's also a major player within the AI field. So all these companies are creating these commercially available artificial intelligence interfaces and APIs for developers to start to be using. And so we're going to be start to seeing it more in these different experiences of games and applications and agents that are in our homes that we're able to have these conversations with. So part of the reason why there's been this switch in the consumer awareness is just that there's just more products and more companies talking about it and a huge hype cycle around it. And with that hype cycle has come this dimension of fear, because of so much of artificial intelligence has been colored by Hollywood and manifestations of super intelligent agents like the Terminator. Now that I've done about 90 interviews, I get a little bit better of an understanding. And as I talk to the researchers, what they continually say is that there's been monotonic improvement of AI slowly and surely since the very beginning. And then what I hear from the researchers is that we're actually a pretty far away from achieving any sort of level of superintelligence. I think philosophically, we could certainly have those debates and discussions, but the risk is that there is going to project out into the future too far and to come up with some fear-based conceptualization around it, such that it's going to not allow us to see where AI is actually at and the capabilities that it's able to do. And as artificial intelligence researchers have their children, then they can start to see these intelligent agents being born and cultivated and slowly taught. And just the anecdote that Rao shared about one of his kids lying to him, and that how he was so proud of that because it showed a sign of intelligence of being able to model another person's mental model and to have something that was different and deviating from that. And that this is something that artificial intelligence agents are going to do to us. What are the ethical implications of artificial intelligence agents who are able to make these mental models of us that may be super accurate? And then how can you be able to ensure that they're not going to manipulate that for malicious purposes? So there's a whole range of fascinating questions that I think we'll be diving into within the Voices of AI and looking at models and frameworks for experiential design, as well as looking at the full wide potential of all the different ways that AI is going to be applied, whether it's in entertainment or education or medicine or communications or technology and society. There's pretty much no domain of human experience that I think that AI is not going to be touching in the future. So I'm super excited to go on this journey with you, exploring all these topics through these many different conversations with researchers. And I hope that you're able to listen to these conversations and just learn a lot more about the field of artificial intelligence and be able to start to dive in and actually start to make AI that you want to see in the world. So this is going to be a listener-supported podcast funded through Patreon. I'm a full-time podcaster for the Voices of VR, and I want to also expand out into doing the Voices of AI as well. I don't know how many episodes per week that I'll be able to do. I hope at least one, maybe two, three, maybe up to five. I've got 90 interviews already, and I have another 200 interviews for the Voices of VR in my backlog. And so I'm sort of trying to manage my time in terms of the interest of these topics. And so if you like this episode and you want to see this continue, then the thing you can do is just donate to my Patreon, and that'll send a clear signal for me to figure out how to balance my time moving forward. I know for sure I'll be continuing the Voices of VR podcast, but I also want to be diving deep into the full potential of AI as well. And I think that going to these conferences and talking to these experts is an amazing way to both learn about a complicated subject, but also to be able to just hear from experts who have been spending their life thinking about these topics and to use them as a guide to help us understand what's happening within the field of artificial intelligence. So if you want to hear more, then become a member of my Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/voicesofai. And, you know, just a few dollars a month makes a huge difference, especially if everybody starts to contribute. So go to patreon.com/voicesofai and donate today. Thanks for listening.